Shad Khan's big plans for downtown Jax are now in question. Duval County students and teachers head back to school, and election night results favor women here in Northeast Florida. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week on our Friday Media Roundtable. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we've got details on a COVID-approved outdoor workout that will refresh your mind and body. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Good to have you on the show once again. Also with us, WJCT's digital editor, Bill Bortsfield. Hey, Bill.
Hey, good morning, Melissa, and good morning, everyone.
Good morning, and rounding out our panel, Jacksonville writer and journalist Nikisha Williams. Hi, Nikisha.
Hey, Melissa, good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Lots to talk about this week. We'll get into the news in just a moment. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID pandemic by the numbers. Statewide, the Department of Health reports that there are 588,602 COVID cases around the state and 10,049 deaths. In our area, the death toll stands at 405. Now, in a moment, we will talk about the first day back to school in Duval County in this pandemic, as students chose, some chose online learning and others chose to go back to school. That's in a few minutes. But first, the biggest story of the week, it looks like there are going to be big changes to Shad Khan's proposed plans to develop the area around the Jaguar Stadium. This week, we learned the development agreement between the city of Jax and Khan has sat dormant for so long that it is now actually expired. Now, the rights to redevelop Metropolitan Park across the street from the stadium have to go out for rebid. And the head of the city's downtown development agency says she expects the Jaguars owner to propose a scaled back project. So what is the fate of this ambitious plan for downtown? Keep in mind, the city tore down those ramps coming off the Hart Bridge to make way for Shad Khan's aggressive planning. Were those ramps torn down in vain? We don't know, but we want to talk about it now with your calls at 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax, and our Facebook page is open. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. No one seems to know where negotiations now stand on Khan's proposed development on Lot J in Metropolitan Park. But what we do know is that those bridge ramps did come down. We've seen the rubble being cleared away for weeks now here at WJCT.
And that's yours and Bill's front yard right now.
That's
obviously,
right.
As you come to work there. But nobody knew that Shad Khan's contract had run out until City Councilman Matt Carlucci asked city officials, hey, can we get an update, and found out that it has sat so dormant for so long that it expired. So now officials are saying, the city development, downtown development agency, saying that she expects Shad Khan to repropose the project, but it's going to be scaled back from that massive piece of art with hotels and concert venues and such.
Yeah, Bill Bortsfield, Khan laid out this incredible proposal for an upscale hotel, a whole downtown entertainment complex, another concert venue, the works. Now, of course, we're in the middle of a pandemic and a recession. It was never really adequately explained how the city was going to pay for its portion of this to begin with. And developers are struggling, not just in Jacksonville, but everywhere, to bring their projects to fruition in this economic climate. So we just don't know if this will ever, what we'll ever end up seeing.
No, we don't know, Melissa. And if you go back to July of last year, you, of course, remember the mayor making a video announcement that he had reached an agreement with Shad Khan. Of course, nothing was actually signed, but we had heard for so long that a deal was imminent, and he did make quite a big deal, him as in the mayor, to say this was happening. And of course, that was before the ramps started coming down. And then, of course, we see that nothing has been signed, and yet $39 million more or less is being budgeted to bring down all of these ramps. And you just got to wonder what this means for the city in terms of a deal. And of course, now we're talking about the rights expiring. We keep hearing about Metropolitan Park, which the city signed an agreement to keep in, you know, basically forever. With the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. And now it's at the center of talks for redevelopment. And yeah, this is going to go on for quite a while. And you got to wonder what sort of incentives the city may offer to try to get some sort of development going, whether it's just Lot J itself, whether it's the Shipyards property or Metropolitan Park.
Yeah. And Nikisha, the city is being roundly criticized for this current state of affairs because, as Bill pointed out, it cost almost $40 million to bring down a perfectly functional road without a solid development timeline ever really put into place. The Metropolitan Park piece of this in particular, I think it raises questions because the city tried to get out of its deal with the National Park Service to clear the way to develop that land, and that did not work. And so we're simply left with a lot of question marks and a lot of money being spent with, at least so far, nothing to show for it.
It's been a mess, and I'd like to turn your attention back to what was that last April after the draft when they had the State of the Jaguars, and the Jaguars president and top executives Mark Lamping and Shah Khan were talking about, you know, those ramps are coming down in January, and then you will see the building start, and it's like, you know, they were had all this boost of confidence of saying, you know, this is happening, this is what we're going to do, you're going to start seeing it in the beginning of the new year. The ramps have come down, and yet we've seen no cranes in the sky to start erecting those new buildings. I also like to say that, you know, this is just part and parcel for Jacksonville's problem of courting and auctioning off this riverfront property to the highest bidder. Remember, they were going to give it to Amazon when Amazon was looking for a second headquarters on the East Coast. But then that didn't work out. So now it's like, well, let's give it back to Shah Khan. And yet there's still no development. And we're seeing the clearing away of building after building after building, such as the old courthouse and project. We've got the landing tore down. So now we have all this riverfront property and space, and there's nothing on it. And there's not even a plan to get something to go to it. I think part of the problem is that the assumption in the media community was that JEA was going to put their new headquarters at Lot J because that was one of the proposals from JEA,
yeah.
But then they didn't. And so now Shah Khan, the city, the developers have all had to rethink what's going to be their anchoring force of this project since the longest tenant, JEA, is not going to be that.
Yeah, that's a good point, Nikisha. And Dan, all of us in the local media who've covered all of these various renderings and proposals for many years, you know, you try not to get too cynical, but it's hard not to when you've seen so many renderings presented that never, ever get built. And this whole notion that someone is finally going to crack the code and develop this waterfront property and bring this area to life, it just always seems to be just out of reach for this city, despite the fact that it's prime downtown waterfront real estate, and so many other cities around the country that don't have our natural assets have managed to do it. They've managed to develop their waterfronts, and it's frustrating that there always seems to be a problem with that in Jacksonville.
Well, we have discussed Lot J on this show for as long as I can remember, but for those of you who are as old as I am, you may remember that back in the 1980s, there was a plan for the Shipyards across from Maxwell House, and it was going to be a multi-use residential property, and that got deep-sixed at the time, literally as there was a shipyard still sort of there, and now here we are again. And don't forget that Shah Khan's attorney and lobbyist, Paul Hardin, told council members a month ago, this is according to Nate Monroe's story this week, that any development would include a public park on the old Shipyards parcel that would be an acre-for-acre replacement for Metro Park. Carlucci says he'd really still like to keep Metro Park where it is. He says it's a sacred public space.
Let's go to your calls now with our Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937. Cynthia in Jacksonville. Hi, Cynthia. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am wondering about the heart and soul of our city in this. When we applied for that grant, there were other people applying for that grant who did not receive them. How fortunate we were to receive them. with an understanding that Metro Park would be a park in perpetuity. And now, without any regard to our promises, we are going to sell it and change it to a different place, a different location. This is not right. 2 years ago, the Marine Association was told that they could no longer have their in-the-water boat show there. It was being used and enjoyed by the whole marine community for that each year. Each year for the football season, people in Jacksonville who own boats dock their boats there to go to the game.
Mm-hmm.
It is used by people who come into town with recreational vehicles for their children's recreation while they're here. There was an international festival there. Matt Carlucci says that it has not been used. It has been used a lot until the kids' campus was torn down in preparation for this Hart Bridge ramp being taken down. And I can understand that, but I don't know where that equipment was put or what happened to it. But it has to do with the heart and soul of our science. Why is it our promise is not important to us?
Yeah.
That we sell Metropolitan Park to anyone. It should be retained as an urban park. It was used by citizens of Springfield as their only access to the river. And people, I realize there are not very many people living in that industrial area near Talleyrand Avenue, but I did a survey one day just talking to people in their yards, and they were using it until it was closed to their use.
Yeah, Cynthia.
So
thank you.
So it has been used, and in the landscaping of it has been retained. The restrooms are in good condition.
Right. No, that's true.
There's no reason to sell it.
Thank you. Yeah. Cynthia, thank you so much for that. Okay. Lots of good points by Cynthia. Bill Bortsfield, of course, Metropolitan Park is right next door to our building, WJCT Studios. You know, she's absolutely right in that the infrastructure there is still in very good condition. There's a beautiful gazebo over there, a beautiful green where people used to go when they would watch concerts before the band shell was torn down. Functioning bathrooms. She's right. I've used them myself when I've walked through there with my kids. But I have to say, you know, when you walk through that whole park area, there's nobody else using it. It's usually deserted. And that's been the case for some time, as she accurately pointed out. But the city is on the hook to keep this space, this green space. They have an agreement with the National Park Service to preserve this waterfront property. Shad Khan and his development guys promised that there would still be waterfront access if they were ever able to figure out a development plan for Metropolitan Park. And the simple fact is we just don't know now what will become of this parcel. It is, as she pointed out, it is in a kind of limbo.
It is. And, you know, I'm going to disagree a little bit. I feel personally that area, that park, has really fallen into disrepair. You know, as Cynthia mentioned, and I know you know as well, and you mentioned, Melissa, I mean, you think of Metropolitan Park today versus 10, 15, or 20 years ago. When I first moved to Jacksonville and my kids were growing up, that was a much more vibrant park. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, the water park there for kids was something fun to take your family to. The concerts you could go to on the weekend at the amphitheater was a hoot. You had a lot of boaters that were coming in as compared to today. Not to say there's no boaters, but we all know, with the exception of a few Jaguars game in Florida, Georgia, that doesn't happen anymore. And, you know, even the Riverwalk itself, I mean, how many years ago has Irma been now? And it still hasn't been repaired from Irma by the city. It's something that's fallen into disrepair. And down the road, you can make the same argument for the landing. In fact, you remember the lawsuit, the dock area was never fixed, so the boat traffic fell off. And, you know, I think some of the more cynical of us in the media were thinking, well, you know, we're going to see the entertainment hub of Jacksonville move from the landing up to Lot J.
Mm-hmm.
The landing's been torn down, but there's a new entertainment complex coming at Lot J. And now everything seems to be stalled. And as we all know, we have more fields than ever in our downtown area.
That's right. Mila in Ponte Vedra. Hello, Mila. Hi, Mila. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes. I think, the potential for downtown is it's huge. I grew up in around the Wembley Stadium area in London. And, it used to be back in the 70s. It used to be, a really horrible rundown area. And now actually it's a go-to place. If folks have been there, it's a fantastic go-to place, with restaurants, bars, and of course, Wembley Stadium's right there, and where concerts are held. It's a major venue, of course. Throughout London, there have been, the great city that central London is, but, in the suburbs, there are pockets, or there have been pockets, which are rundown pockets, which have been redeveloped. Another area is Canary Wharf, a really rundown, horrible area. You'd never go there, but, these places have become go-to places now. With major venues and restaurants and bars, etc. So I think given the right public-private partnership, I'm certain Shahid Khan will come back. Because he obviously knows about Wembley Stadium at least. So I'm pretty certain he'll be back. Given the right public-private partnership opportunity.
Thanks, Mila.
I think the other thing, if I could just add, Jacksonville could look to is, look what's been done in St. John's Town Centre. Look what's been done in, Tinseltown in Southside and, some of the other, nicer places, that we have here, something along those lines.
Okay. Thanks, Mila. And the DIA chief, Lori Boyer, did say that to keep the faith that Shahid Khan will still propose something. That said, Nikisha, there is a lot of cynicism about this. Here is a comment on Facebook from Dan. I doubt anything will ever come of the shipyards until I see someone break ground. They can't even get the owners to tear down that half-built hellhole across the street from the sheriff's department. That's the half-built residential tower that's been sitting empty for over a decade downtown. And as Teresa emails the show, Jacksonville seems to be a city where big developments are announced and then are aborted or postponed. When I first moved here 7 years ago, I was told there was going to be a Publix development in San Marco. I'm still waiting. Okay, so there's so much cynicism about this news, Nikisha, because we've been through this so many times before. And I think for people that really care about this city, they want so badly for it to jump to the next phase, to become more of a top tier city. They see the potential, as Mila pointed out. They've lived in other cities where they've seen that kind of potential realized, and they want it so badly for this city. And so when there are setbacks like this, it's tough.
It's like you felt and saw me rolling my eyes at home.
Right.
The city does have a lot of potential, but I feel like that whole, Shahid Khan's going to come back to the table. Why are we waiting for Shahid Khan to develop the city? Yes, he's a billionaire, but he has no obligations to develop the city. He has no obligations other than to the Jacksonville. He didn't sign up to be Captain Save of Jacksonville. He signed up to be the owner of our football team. So think about what the city needs to have entertainment and a grocery store and all of those things downtown. You first need people living there. So either finish the Berkman 2 or tear it down and rebuild something else. But you need residential housing and you need people to live there. Those people are going to need a grocery store. They're also going to need somewhere to shop. So that's where you can build your retail. When I first moved to Jacksonville in 2011, the Landing had a Banana Republic and a Nine West and all of these stores that slowly went out of business because there was nobody living there to patronize them. That all needs to come back. Whatever happened to that aquarium plant people were talking about putting on the waterfront? I'm from Chicago. We have a whole museum campus around our stadium. There's a Bears Stadium. There's the Field Museum. There's the Planetarium. And there's an aquarium all in walking distance of the stadium. You can do it. It can be done. But don't hold your hopes on Shahid Khan or any other billionaire investor saying that's the ticket when it turns out to be not the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Dixie in Orange Park. Hello, Dixie. Go ahead,
the
Dixie.
The green space made perfect sense to me. I thought that it was a logical plan based on the idea that we're facing climate change with rising water levels and increasingly severe storms. So why are they planning to Uber develop the waterfront after making that commitment? It doesn't make any sense with the rising water levels and the ferocious hurricanes that we're facing.
Thank you, Dixie. I'm so glad you pointed that out. We have been looking into that here at WJCT News. And Dan Scanlon, the TU, has reported on this as well. These development plans really didn't get that kind of climate vetting that they likely needed, correct?
I don't think they got far enough along. That's something that happens when you really start planning. And as I realize, I'm looking at an aerial map. We have so many outdoor concert and indoor concert venues right now around Tia Bank Field. Metro Park still has a stage. I've been to a concert that used that stage with parking across the street. We have Daly's Place. We have Tia Bank Field. We have the Vistar Veterans Memorial. And just up the street, the TU Center and Florida Theater. So many places right now with parking garages near them and parking lots for you to go see a concert. I don't think we need another concert venue down there. What is being said is we need residential. We need to finish Berkman 2 or clear it out. And we need some public park space with some kind of people-friendly development, even maybe some kind of nature walk to connect that section of waterfront.
Clyde emails the show, don't forget many of us are still wondering if the destruction of the landing wasn't part of this. Has there been a single success in the Curry administration? Why do we still trust this gang who can't shoot straight? Bill Bortsfield, the Curry administration is coming under a lot of criticism for this news because, as you said, there's a lot of other buildings that have been torn down downtown, and we are still waiting for the plan to emerge as to what will go up in their place. Now, that's not to say that we can't eventually see that happen. It could happen. But at the moment, I think it's fair to say there's a lot of frustration as to where we are right now.
Yeah, and of course, the Curry administration's final chapter is yet to be written. So, I mean, certainly we don't know. I mean, to Melia's point earlier, you know, when he was talking about London and Wembley and the vibrancy, I mean, certainly we could see that in Jacksonville. I mean, the beautiful part of this is we do have an open canvas available to us along our riverfront. So the potential, you know, is huge, no question about it. And only time is going to tell whether tearing down the landing and clearing out the Hart Expressway ramps was the right thing to do. And in some cities, we see this happens very quickly and redevelopment gets going. And in other cities, we don't. You know, I'm a child of urban displacement myself. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. My family's row house was the subject of eminent domain. We were moved, and that neighborhood was torn down, and it laid dormant for more than a decade after everything was torn down. So, I mean, it really does depend on the city. Some cities really move forward quick. And we have to remember, too, the landscape is very different now than when this all started. I mean, when we were talking about Lot J and all this other development, it was the before times, before COVID-19.
Yeah,
now we're in a
yeah.
deep recession, and we all remember what happened to Jacksonville after the Great Recession. I mean, Dan mentioned it. You've mentioned it. All the beautiful renderings we saw. I mean, since I've lived here, I've seen multiple plans come and go for the shipyards as just one example. Boy, if an artist out there got together and put some sort of collage of every rendering that's
right.
ever been done.
I said
the
that
South
the other
Bank
day. We
North
should
Bank.
Make a scrapbook.
Wow.
That's right.
But I mean, certainly at this point, we've all got to hope that good does come out of it. And there are some deals being made. But I think we also as a community have to look at the opportunity we have with this riverfront and the opportunity to also create great park space. You know, we have to be very careful we don't give away everything as well, because I mean, we're only going to get one chance to do our river right.
Absolutely right. And you're right, we do need to take the long view. That's such an important perspective to hold. That said, so far the only people that are making any money out of all these plans through the years are the architectural firms. that have drawn up all of these renderings that we've all been treated to looking at. Okay, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Dan Scanlon, Nakisha Williams, Bill Bortsfield, and myself. And we are going to shift gears now and talk about some other big news from the week. Let's talk about the first day back to school. A few hiccups with online learning Thursday and students bottlenecking in school hallways as Duval County Public Schools welcomed students back into the classroom. Now, about 60% of students around Jacksonville decided to go back to in-person class. The rest chose online learning because of COVID-19 concerns. And hybrid learning will be the order of the day for the time being, Dan Scanlon. And so parents, students, teachers, and faculty and staff had a lot of anxiety about this. It's a new normal for education in Florida and for much of the country for at least the time being. I know that over at the Times Union, you covered the first day of school. It could have been a lot worse, I think, is the way most people felt.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was out yesterday morning at 8 o'clock, and I saw a lot of school buses out there. So for me, it looked like the first day of school, but 60%, about 60% of the 111,000 students are expected to show up. We had 172 teacher absences, some of those 67 reporting they were out sick, not too much higher than last year when they stayed home for whatever reason. So again, the teachers aren't too concerned. But I'm still envisioning classrooms with the plastic and cardboard dividers, with dispensers of hand sanitizer, with masks and face shields for the young kids, and how that all works out when kids are being kids.
Yeah. Bill Bortsfield, that's right. You know, some teachers we've interviewed around town chose to retire rather than go back into the classroom because they were worried about COVID. Some parents have chosen to keep their children at home. The virus, the percentage of positive cases in our area is declining somewhat. So that is the piece of good news, I think, as classes begin.
Yeah, and I mean, I talked to somebody in Duval's education system over the weekend, and you know, she was concerned about things going back, and she had some choice words about how she felt about things that I won't repeat. You know, and I'll tell you, Will Dickey of the Florida Times Union, he had a stunning photo that's on jacksonville.com today. It's the line of students waiting with their parents to get their temperatures taken at Beau Claire Elementary on the first day of school. And certainly the system is going to be refined. Things are going to get better each and every day. But when you see that line on the very first day of school, it does really make you wonder. And of course, a lot of the virtual students, I won't say a lot, but certainly some of the virtual students had issues with Duval Homeroom and Microsoft Teams that the district alerted us and all the families to. And again, some of that's all to be expected on the first day. But when you look at that picture and you hear about the virtual issues the first day, it is a stark reminder that things are not normal right now.
Yeah. Nakisha, the superintendent, Diana Green, and the mayor also announced this rapid testing protocol for teachers and employees of the Duval County Public Schools so that if somebody does test positive for COVID, they can be quarantined. We've also heard this week at the private Bowles School, an Episcopal school, they've already been quarantining classes because of a number of positive cases. So this is going to continue to be an issue.
It absolutely is. And I said this the last time you had me on, Melissa, is that collectively as a city, a county, a state, a country, we did not do what we needed to do in March, April, May, June, and July in order to not just flatten the curve, but to decimate it. And as soon as things began to open up around Memorial Day, we've seen cases skyrocket, deaths skyrocket, and it's all been heading toward school. My son is five years old. I work from home. I cannot be tethered to a desk from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. while he's in school when I need to work. So he has to go to school in person with his mask on. He has a face shield. He told me yesterday when he got in class, I said, well, did you wear your mask? He's like, no, I put on my face shield. My teacher said I could go back and forth and switch off whatever I was comfortable with. And so I haven't seen the inside of his school. I haven't met his teacher. I don't know what anything looks like. I drive up, I drop him off. He's taken out of my car, unbuckled by the teacher or principal, and ushered into school. And all I can do is drop off. I have no idea what things are like for my 5-year-old son. And it's anxiety ridden. But I also know that I can't keep him home either, because as a 5-year-old, he needs to have interaction. He needs to have in-person learning. And I appreciate the rapid testing, but honestly, I fully expect schools to probably shut down in a month and for us to do this all over again in October and November, especially once flu season gets bad. And I'm just not looking forward to it.
I have two kids, my husband and I, in the Duval County Public Schools. They're older than yours, Nakisha. And yes, I think you're probably right. Dan Scanlon, you know, we chose one of our children is going to hybrid learning. One decided to do Duval homeroom for now. But I think Nakisha makes a really good point. If this pandemic had been handled appropriately at the beginning of 2020, we wouldn't be in this position now heading into Labor Day. And I think that there is a pretty good chance that the schools will shut down again. I think we have to be prepared for that possibility.
Well, you know, we're helping our grandson go to school virtually. And so therefore, we are well aware as grandparents, acting as parents, what it takes to have a child at home who all summer long has been at home and not had interaction, not had a chance to play, doing so much better last year when he was in class, with the normal school life. So you're right. I'm expecting to see some numbers rise. Don't forget that the Episcopal and Bowles kids, apparently some of them were together at some event, and so that could have increased the risk of getting COVID-19. And kids, again, will be kids, and masks and shields and social distancing may not be the case. There was even a Stanton College prep student yesterday who told our Emily about the fact that there was some bunching up at their school yesterday and no social distancing, a mistake apparently possibly attributed to them being freshmen and not knowing what to do.
And a tweet from a listener, effective hybrid learning requires universal broadband at no charge to families with kids in schools. Thanks for that. The Duval County Public Schools has moved mountains trying to get laptops and internet hotspots to families around town. But yes, online learning is far from ideal, as we have all learned. Okay, it's our Friday roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week, 549-2937. Let's talk about the Tuesday primary election results. A fairly low turnout Tuesday, about 25% of you out there cast ballots across Duval County. Now, across the WIM region, women were the big winners. Michelle Cook, for example, is now Clay County Sheriff, defeating the embattled Daryl Daniels, who is in a lot of legal trouble. St. Johns County elected a new sheriff. That was another notable race. A local race for judge saw attorney Rhonda Peoples-Waters triumph over sitting judge Aaron Perry. This was an historic first for Jacksonville, the first time voters have elected an African-American candidate to judge ever. In the past, they have always been appointed. And there are some other races to discuss, but as we talk about the race or the election night, let me ask you about this, Nakisha. Robust Democratic turnout in early and election day voting, and this race for with Rhonda Peoples-Waters winning her seat for judge showed I think in some respects a harbinger of the kind of turnout we might see in November in this city when voters go to the polls to choose a new president. Reading the tea leaves about how the race has played out and the breakdown in turnout, what are your thoughts?
First, congratulations to Rhonda Peoples-Waters. I know she's run for a couple of different elected positions, and she's won this race, and I'm looking really forward to seeing her ascend to the bench. As far as reading the tea leaves of what may come in November, I think this has been something that's been happening since, special election in Alabama a few years ago with Doug Jones and Roy Moore, when it was because Black women showed up and voted at 98% for Doug Jones that he defeated Roy Moore and ascended to become the first Democratic, was it a Senate race?
U.S.
in Alabama
Senate.
In some decades?
Yeah.
I think that kind of shows you where things are headed. There's a meme that's online that says, thank Black women, and that whenever something goes wrong, we are the group and the demographic that people turn to right the course. And so if you, even if you take that as just a joke or an online meme, it shows you that there is stake and stock in the political capital of African-American women. Look at the vice presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. It is a Black woman. And so resting there, that kind of shows you what the Democratic Party or what the electorate is kind of looking toward and trying to get to for November and for other elections, be they local, state, federal. And that's great and all, but it also needs to become a dual conversation of, you know, what's being done in return. How are our elected officials going to be accountable to us when we're helping them get into office?
Thanks for that. Bill Bortsfield, as I mentioned, pretty low turnout overall for a primary election, about 25%. So that's not to be, that's not unexpected. We now turn our eyes toward the November general election. And as Nikisha pointed out, African Americans, particularly African American women in Duval County, can make a difference at the ballot box. And Duval County is trending more Democratic. We may see more evidence of that in November. Certainly both Joe Biden and Donald Trump really want to win Duval County because Duval County helps pick presidents in this swing state of Florida.
Yeah, and I'm going to go ahead and look at my own district. I live in City Council District 4, and so, of course, we had a special election for a new city council member, and a Democrat came out on top in the primary, and that has been traditionally a very Republican stronghold. In fact, one of the former city council members that represented that district for a couple of terms, Don Redmond, came in third place, while Nicole Hamm, who is an African-American lady, she gathered 43% of the vote. Now, certainly you can't take too much from one district in the city, and a primary is not a general election. We all know that. But it does show that, at least in this one micro example, a stronger showing by Democrats. And, you know, Duval County did have a fairly low turnout, but some of our counties did better. For example, over in Baker County, the turnout was almost 43%. Now, if you jump up to Nassau County, they did not as good as Baker, but significantly better than Duval. They were just under 38%. And if you go over to Clay, which, of course, had arguably the most covered race across the region with the sheriff's race.
Michelle
Cook. Yeah, their turnout was just a hair under 33%. So, you know, big question, obviously, in November is going to be whether you're the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, how you get your side to turn out and tip that scale in your favor.
Yeah, the turnout game will be critical. Dan, you've been looking at the numbers for Duval as well.
Well, you know, Mike Hogan, the supervisor of elections, told me that on Tuesday he was very disappointed with the numbers. He thought there'd be a little more. But as far as the numbers, 81,881 Democrats voted in Duval versus 67,459. And University of Florida political scientist Mike Binder told the Times Union that while August primaries normally aren't predictive of November, he was stunned by how many more Democrats than Republicans voted. And he said, could this be telling for November? It's possible. It could be.
Possibly, yes. Anna emails the show, I want to express my congratulations to Rhonda Peoples-Waters and Angie Nixon, two candidates I was rooting for. Angie Nixon defeated State Rep Kimberly Daniels in a closely watched race here in Jacksonville. The Kimberly Daniels, a controversial local political figure, frequently at war with her own party. She may switch parties, Nikisha. She kind of hinted at that after losing her election. She may become a Republican and have a future in Republican politics.
And I'm not surprised that she might switch parties. Very much congratulations to Angie Nixon, whom I do know, on her win in that primary. But if Kimberly Daniels switches parties, it will just remind me of when Charlie Crist switched parties. Kimberly Daniels is very much a conservative evangelical, and so her politics do align more with the Republican Party. And so if she switches parties and runs against Angie Nixon in the general election, then we'll see what the outcome will be. But that's not surprising to me, considering some of the things that she has said in the past, considering some of her policies when she was on city council, and some of the issues that she supports.
And before we wrap this up, let's make note of a couple of other news and notes from the week. The 40-year-old son of City Council President and former Mayor Tommy Hazzouri was arrested Wednesday and charged with 25 counts of child pornography. Our partner News for Jax reports Tommy Hazzouri Jr., who is listed as a second grade teacher at Mayport Coastal Sciences Elementary School, was booked into the Duval County Jail Wednesday night. We will follow that story. And also, the City of Jax Chief Administrative Officer Brian Hughes invoked executive privilege when a City Council Investigative Committee asked him to remember his conversations with the mayor over their look at what went wrong into the failed attempt to privatize JEA. Bill Bortzfeld, does that executive privilege claim hold water?
No, when I read that story in the Florida Times Union today, I was just fascinated by it. I'm no lawyer. So I'm not about to speculate on whether it does or doesn't. I can tell you public perception-wise, it certainly doesn't look good that the mayor's administration would feel that it needs to go down that road to begin with, though.
That's right. Dan Scanlon, presidents usually are the ones that assert executive privilege when they're being investigated by Congress, not local chiefs of staff to mayors of cities.
And it's a chief of staff, not even an elected official, who's making that statement. I don't know. I'm not, again, like Bill says, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know where that might have come from. He might have actually found it in some statute somewhere. But what a strange world we're living in right now. And also, just to update you, Hazzouri's bond bail yesterday was lowered by his attorney, Hancock's. And as soon as the investigation was revealed, he was taken out of Mayport Elementary School and had not been there for a few weeks.
Okay, thank you for that. And thank you so much to all three of you for breaking down a very busy news week once again around town as we welcomed Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union, author and journalist Nikesha Williams, and WJCT's digital editor Bill Bortzfeld. Thanks to all of you, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much. A quick break, and up next, have you been hesitant to go back into the gym because of the pandemic, but you still really need a workout or just something to help you with stress, something to refresh your mind and body? Well, in a moment, we will drop into a COVID-approved yoga class in our area that you can do while still socially distancing. That is in a moment. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
Season is here, and JEA is doing everything possible to prepare. And you can too, by updating your contact information and signing up for alerts. You can stay up to date on power restoration efforts. Update your contact info today at JEA.com.
The Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Is your business suffering because of coronavirus? Your insurance policy may already provide coverage. Not sure how to tell? Learn more at TerrellHogan.com.
The Florida Times Union, a trusted name in local news, weather, and sports for over 150 years, continue to support local journalism. Jacksonville.com for more information on digital and print subscriptions.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorm.org.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, COVID has caused some people to wash up less.
I do shower less often, and I don't wear deodorant as often as I used to.
The upside? Better skin. Do we really need to wash away the microbiome on our skin? Redefining healthy skin on the next Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Tomorrow at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Kamala Harris makes history, the Postmaster General makes a hasty retreat, and Michigan makes a deal to settle with the victims of Flint's water crisis. I'm Jen White. Plenty going on this week, and we'll catch ourselves up on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to receive the powerful benefits of a yoga class while still being safe and social distancing. Alexandra Nee is running COVID-approved yoga classes in our area. She told me how she does it.
Alexandra, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one thing I really miss right now in this pandemic is yoga class because it's so good for stress and health and peace of mind. You're doing yoga, but you're doing small group outdoor classes, correct? How is that going?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, in this the circumstances we're in with the pandemic and social distancing and other prerequisites that all yoga studios are obliged to have, I'm doing my classes outdoors, and they're limited to 5 people maximum. And we're still, even being outdoors, we're still socially distanced. And then after the class is over, all prop and all the surfaces are disinfected for the next session.
Sure. So it's a safe way to get the benefits of this ancient practice. And we need it more than ever right now, don't we?
I cannot agree more. As you mentioned, it's not only good for your physical condition, for your physical body, but it's also a mental and emotional release. And most of my classes, including group sessions, they all conclude with a guided meditation of at least 10 minutes where people have a chance to just be present and calm and still in their mind for the day.
Yeah. This is something I think a lot of people are seeking right now. And in addition to this offering, I'm interested to ask you about what else you're doing. You're the only instructor in Jacksonville who is teaching yoga trapeze classes. Now, this is fascinating. This is a suspension anti-gravity yoga. How does this work?
Yes, you're correct. I think the most, maybe, the easiest to understand term would be to call it suspension yoga. You may also have heard of aerial yoga and aerial silks. They all sort of fall into this anti-gravity type of yoga practice, but this particular concept was developed by Yoga Body and Yoga Teachers College in Barcelona. And it has as a main as all other aerial and anti-gravity yoga practices, but it also has a lot of straps, which adds ability to develop and improve your upper body strength, your grip strength, and your core strength. That in mat yoga class is often, let's say, less easy achievable. So the yoga trapeze classes are set as private sessions only, and each student can bring a plus one free of charge. And we work out as well outside, so they normally set up in the morning. And times clients fall in love so much and they feel and see the results and they're physical strength and flexibility and mobility so quickly that they're actually eager to have their own set up at home. And in that case, we either switch from they come into me, or I often also do the house visits, the house calls for private clients.
Nice. I would think people who are finding you in this time are really feeling so much better, because this is such a therapeutic practice for so many modern day ailments, general stress and anxiety, but also people who suffer from chronic pain. There are just a wealth of benefits to this. And people, I think, are still a little reluctant to go back into a traditional classroom environment. So what are they telling you, your clients, when they come to you for either for the outdoor yoga or the trapeze yoga?
Well, normally the trapeze yoga, because they're more customized for a particular client, we start with just a brief session where I get to know if there are any concerns, any medical restrictions or injuries, and of course their goals. If the goal is just to relieve the pain, then that's the, let's say, the most beautiful part, the most beautiful element of yoga trapeze is the relief of your back pain, any cervical pain. And the clients show improvement and relief sometimes even within two sessions. Maybe to explain a little bit more, in yoga trapeze, you have an ability to use your own body weight and, let's say, reverse the force of gravity, because you're going into inversion, you're going upside down, but there's no stress on any joint, stress on any muscle, and you literally relax under your own weight, submitting to the gravity, which creates space in your spinal joints. And this is what is critical for the health of our spinal health.
It is such a wonderful option right now. And kudos to you, Alexandra. I'm sure you've got some really happy customers out there. You can find Alexandra Nee online at wellness.alexandranee.com.
And that's our show. Whatever fitness program you choose, I hope you're enjoying it and it's bringing you some peace. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup, where we'll round up the biggest news around the state this week and take your calls statewide. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back Monday, and please keep wearing your masks.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.